It's usually $1 million of annual waste for every 50 people in an organization. Just in kind of garbage work that we're too busy to become less busy around. And it's amazing the tolerance of that. If you had that in a manufacturing environment, no one would allow that to remain. The Lean Six Sigma consultants would descend from the ceiling and they'd clean it in 10 minutes. Because no one ever, but what's funny in the knowledge worker space, we just have this odd complacency around wasting time.
Welcome to the Beyond Speaking podcast from Premier Speakers Bureau, featuring in-depth conversations with the world's most in-demand keynote speakers.
Hi, I'm Brian Lord, president of Premier Speakers Bureau. Welcome to the Beyond Speaking podcast. Our guest today is Juliette Funt. She is a globally renowned keynote speaker, a tough love advisor to Fortune 500 companies. She's the founder and CEO of the efficiency training firm the Juliette Funt Group. She's also the author of A Minute to Think, which we'll be talking about. And she's spoken to a ton of different companies, Spotify, National Geographic, ESPN, Sephora, Wells Fargo, Nike, and many others. And most impressively, Juliette knows how to make a swan out of an apple. So maybe, I don't know if you're prepared for demonstration afterwards or you just want to, you know, tell us about that. And I'm kidding. I'm a shock. I love to do the shock and awe question. Anyway, so ladies and gentlemen, welcome Juliette Funt. Juliette, thank you so much for coming and being a part of the podcast.
Thank you. I'm sitting here trying to figure out how to make my cell phone into a swan, but I don't think it's talking to it. It's the only thing I have right here.
So. Yeah, well, that's the thing is you should not brag about something on your website and not be prepared to do it at all times. You just
There's going to be an apple and a knife standing by at all future podcasts, I will tell you.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, so Juliette, I know back to sort of the business folks of things here. I know you're an expert on high performance. What are you, you know, just kind of, we're looking at these things, getting towards the second half or into the second half here of 2023. What are you hearing from business leaders that you're talking to about where we are and where we should be going?
Yes. What's fascinating about my vantage point is we spend time with so many different leaders in so many different sectors. So we can really be an objective fly on the wall to what's happening. And I think it's been such a fascinating trajectory from COVID to post-COVID craziness to the confusion of hybrid, still in that. And now what I'm noticing is that almost every leader I talk to says we're in a massive transformation, as if they feel that they're very unique, that they're doing a massive transformation. And I think that we're all transforming and transforming. And the big question is, are we taking a minute to think to decide really how we should be transforming? There's so much executing and so much doing. I'm seeing a real worrisome deficit in time to really step back, think, ponder, plan, reflect as leaders before executing these transformations. And I think that comes out of the free-floating anxiety post-COVID, all of the change impact, all of the emotion. There is a temptation now to act. And I think we really have to pause and think and make these next sets of transformations very intentional. I think we'll get out of them what we put into them in terms of thinking time.
How much time should you put into thinking? Like if you're talking to these leaders, like is that, are you saying 6 months? Are you saying 8 minutes a day? Or, you know, what's kind of the, I know everyone's different, but what's kind of the most common advice for you to give to someone for around this?
Yeah. How about any? Just any time where you pause acquiring, creating, building, making, doing, and you step back from all of it and say, wow, this is a spectacular blank page I have. The world was transformed. We're ready to change. What do I want to write on that page? What should it look like? What's the legacy for me as a leader that I'm writing with my own pen that I can look back on in 5, 10, 15, or 20 years and be proud of? These are the non-transactional activities that people don't do. So if we want to get prescriptive, which I usually don't, we just want a few little pieces in the day. Sometimes it can be transitional thinking time, 3 minutes here, 5 minutes there. For leaders, if you're really doing visioning work, I'm hoping that you're stepping back for at least 15 to 30 minutes to step aside. I hope that you're putting aside technology, and I hope that you're on paper, hopefully planning and creating with a pen or post-its or something tactile and analog so that your mind can be free. And I'd say anything over 30 minutes is gravy at this point.
Mm-hmm. And how does that make you feel? Like, one of the things I really like when you're talking about this, you know, whether it's leaders, whoever might be, approaching this, is it's permission and then tools. It's the mindset and then those functional things. So at the end of this, we will get into that, more of those tools and functional types of things. But I think it's the mental aspect. It's this, I feel like in general, that there's like this guilt about not doing something. Yes. And it's not that your thinking is doing something, but it's not what people would normally do. So where does that permission come from, and how does it change once people give themselves that permission?
Yes. So it can come from a lot of different places. We use science, we use modeling, we use charismatic testimony of people who've given themselves permission. But in the science realm, when you're taking what looks like a pause or a thinking moment, you could put an MRI on your brain and you'd see this amazing complex activity that would validate the fact that you're pursuing insight and creativity and innovation all in those supposedly empty spaces. If we were using a modeling perspective, you could pick a big shot that you wish you were, and they take thinking time for granted, and you can look to them. You can look to Bill Gates, who took 2 weeks a year to just go off in a cabin and think, or Phil Knight from Nike, who had a designated chair in his living room that was only used for daydreaming. And you can find these sources of people who understand that it'd be just a tragedy to build it before you dreamed it. And so there's lots of places, and that permission gets really important at the leadership level, but then it gets critically important as we go down from there, because the pauses I'm talking about, they do allow you to vision and strategize and plan, but they also allow people to recover and keep their energy up and keep their mind sharp and focused and be agile as a team. And when you get further down from leaders, there's less and less and less permission to ever stop the maniacal metronome of work. That's why we care so much about people doing this work in an intact setting, so everybody has the permission and everybody understands that when you have white space or open time, the organization and the people can benefit.
And how does that affect the culture? So culture is a really important thing. People are asking about how they can improve their culture. How does this affect the culture?
Well, first of all, I think that culture is a word that makes you want to step around it. It's hard. It's complex. It sounds really expensive. It sounds like dozens of people need to buy in. It sounds laborious, but culture is just a quilt made up of patches, and each patch is a norm. So if you focus on the word norm and you don't worry about the big scary word culture, you say, what will our norms be here around boundaries or communication or taking vacation or saying no? And you can craft norms one at a time in a manageable way. And then all of a sudden you find that you've built a quilt of culture. And so I really think that that's a more, it's an easier on-ramp for most people than to think about the C word.
Yeah. And that is one of those things that, in just looking at, as you're kind of developing these thoughts, you know, future of work, yes, is saying that, what does the future of work look like for a company that builds in, we'll say, the culture, but builds in this white space, this open time? What does that look like for the future work for those companies?
We call it humanistic high performance. It's high performance without the torture. and there are ways of doing this. It's so fantastic to see when leaders embrace it. We just had a small solar company, well, small for us, 1,300 people in a solar company went through our work. They had a 54% increase in time for meaningful work in 14 weeks. Not because it's rocket science, not because we're the most brilliant people in the world, but because they became intentional about, what do I do every day? How much of it is wasteful? How many minutes do I sit in stupid Slack threads and stupid meetings and nonsense emails and not say anything and just take the pain? And instead they became intentional, and they liberated their people so that they could have time to do the things that bring them joy and reward and a sense of meaning at work. And that is, I don't want to oversimplify what's a very difficult transition, because behavior change is always very hard, but it is amazing to see where intentionality can take you.
How does that, what are some of those things? Because whenever there is change or difficult things, and for leaders, those watching this or listening to this, you know that there are going to be those difficult times. What are those things that, hey, you're going to do this, it's going to be great, but here are the tough things that happen?
So let's define white space, because we haven't done that yet. For people who may not know, white space is defined as time without assignment. It's time that you don't really have an agenda for. And it came from, the reason that it's white is it came from 20 years ago when I was coaching executives, and we'd look at the paper of their paper calendar. The first line of defense for an overloaded, taxed out executive who isn't getting good work done is to see how much white is on the days, how much actual white space is there where you're going to sit at your desk and do something that you choose, not that the calendar pulls you like a water buffalo through the, what is it, a rice patch, a paddy? And so we really want those spaces. And the organizational implementation of this space has many purposes. People think of it as recuperative, and it is. It is to reboot the body. It is to reboot the frontal lobe, all the important things that we need in terms of recuperative space. But it's also constructive. It's where strategy happens. It's where questioning assumption happens. And it's where creativity and innovation happens. I'll give you a tiny little tangent story, and then I'll answer your question. So there's a guy I love who's in the book who I talk about. His name is John. He's a security guard at a Fortune 200 company. And this company has one real main aspiration is patents. They like to file a lot of patents. So they have an innovation department. And yet it just so happens that this guy, John, the security guard, holds the record for filing the most patents in the company. And so I went to interview him, and he's a very unusual guy, and he's really smart, as you might guess. But there is more to that than that. It came to be that we found out by sitting together that a big part of his success was that his job is 95% white space and 5% prescribed action, because his job is to wait in case something happens. So he had all this iterative, playful time to dance with ideas and make them wrong and make them right and take a right turn and a left turn. And the funny thing of the story is that when he got promoted, which he did, into the innovation department, he got a new title and he got a new salary. And two different times now they've tried this, and two different times now he's returned to security, because as soon as they made him an innovation guy, they filled his day with all this corporate crap, and then he couldn't think anymore. And then all the creating stopped. And so if you ever have a moment where you think of white space as a luxury item or a personal item or a wellness item, you remember that everything you want as a company is tied to differentiation and breakthrough. And that's what this time is for.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. You ask them, why is it hard? It's hard for a million reasons. We're really used to not having it. We have internalize the metronome of the crazy, busy, never-ending, fast-forward Tai Chi day that we all live in. And a lot of things that we see in terms of the implementation when we go into clients to really help them change is they don't want to involve everyone. And this is a really subtle thing I think that's interesting, is they want a lot of training firms come in and teach the leaders only. We don't do that. And so they're used to it. They come and they go, can we just teach the leaders? But unless you make that permission uniform, communal, unless there's an intactness to the idea, it's really going to break apart really quickly. So we think a lot of places that people fall down is they teach the leaders anything, could be our stuff, could be something else. And then they hope that the leaders will then teach their downline. That's kind of like sending the leaders to therapy and then saying that they should go fix other people. They don't know how to do that. And that's often where it breaks down.
Are there any other freeing moments? I know you talked about the security guard. Maybe not everyone can go have 95% of their day done. What's the most common thing for those sort of non-leadership positions that companies are not used to maybe investing as much into or giving as much change to?
Yeah. So now that brings us into the tactical, which is good because we've been sort of theoretical so far. So the main levers that we pull to create white space are reducing waste and increasing permission. Reducing waste has to do with looking at a quantification of emails, meetings, decks, and reports that are low value, but that persist in the workflow. And this kind of capacity management is possible, again, the more intact you are, the better. But you want to look at, where are we spending our time? We have a thing that is a little too long to go through that's a capacity management process, but I'll tell you one little section of it, the P's of low value work. The P's of low value work are panicking, pandering, procedure, and padding. And if you explore them, you'll find a lot of white space. So panicking is stuff where you're just moving so quickly that you're grabbing tasks without thought. Pandering is tasks that remain on a list just because you're kissing up to some senior big shot and you don't know how to say no. Padding is all the extra word count, the extra meetings, the extra Slack garbage. and then procedure, red tape, bureaucracy, et cetera. So even if you begin there in terms of reducing waste, having team dialogue to say, hey, where are we maybe pandering, maybe pattering, pandering or stuck in procedure, you can begin to cut items. And we call this having a reductive mindset. The mathematical reduction, stripping away, letting go can give you quite a bit of initial white space. But then you have to pair it with this permission to say no, not feel guilty or like you're going to be in trouble, permission to set a boundary, permission to question work and its value. And when you start pairing this waste reduction with this permission, I would say that's the first tranche of what really excites people and gets things going. And then you start bringing in tools, which we can go into, meeting tools, email tools, et cetera.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, that's one of those things. And out of curiosity, what's your one that you have to tackle the most out of those four?
One of the members of my team came to me a couple of weeks ago and said they were overloaded. They were feeling that feeling like it was kind of up here. We took them through this process that I was telling you about called RPMs. It's a LinkedIn article I actually just wrote a couple of weeks ago. If people want to subscribe to my LinkedIn newsletter, they can see the RPMs of capacity management. And an hour and 10 minutes later, she felt completely better. Because sometimes we just need to stop and question what we're doing and how we're doing it. So in this particular regard, I think we're pretty good at eating our own cereal, Kool-Aid. What's drinking our own Kool-Aid, eating our own cereal.
Sure.
Whatever. But I'm sure you go into other areas where I have to work harder to be aligned with my content.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I'm going through those, like, I don't do a whole lot of things where I'm just doing it just to be nice or whatever, but I do have certain things like it's just out of habit, or you do things because they're easy. Like do easy things to avoid hard things. I'm like, oh, I can send out these random emails, or I can tackle this really 50 thing, you know, contract.
That's all padding. Padding. So we would call that padding. I think probably most people are worst at padding. We have a very unique quantification process when we work with clients for longer than a month. We quantify their busy work. We get salary data. We ask people where their padding is and we do the math. It's usually $1 million of annual waste for every 50 people in an organization. Just in kind of garbage work that we're too busy to become less busy around. And it's amazing the tolerance of that. If you had that in a manufacturing environment, no one would allow that to remain. The Lean Six Sigma consultants would descend from the ceiling and they'd clean it for 10 minutes because no one ever, but what's funny in the knowledge worker space, we just have this odd complacency around wasting time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm here to help with, I guess.
So to unpack, so you've got those four different areas there. What are tools to attack at least one or two of those?
Yes. So let's go for the yellow list, one of my favorites. So this will help minimize email and other communications. The yellow list is just a document that you keep in your phone or computer for each person that you work with really frequently. So I might have a Brian yellow list and a Jamie yellow list. When I am about to type something, I'm about to Slack or chat or IM or email, I pause and say, wait, is there a reason I'm putting this in a digital channel? Or couldn't I just jot it down on the yellow list for the next time I talk to this person? And as you develop that impulse control, you abstain from adding to the digital channel. And this is where all the weight comes. This is all also where all the emails go out. And then they have babies. And then those emails have babies. And those emails have babies because we keep adding to the flow. That all stops when you start putting things on a yellow list. And then 3 days later, let's say I ping you, hey, Brian, my yellow list is getting a little long. You got 15 minutes. We go boom, boom, boom. No CCs, no reply to all. The three-dimensionality and richness of a conversation, all benefits of the yellow list. And so that one, if you start doing it as an intact team, can really, really change your meeting calendar. Mm-hmm. Another one I'll give you is your emails. Another one I'll give you about meetings is one of my favorites is called opting out. And there's also on call. So let me think which one we should. Well, opting out is basically our fancy version of saying no to a meeting, but it's a little more complex because we encourage coaching and practice. I think it's often underestimated how hard it is for people to say a simple no to a meeting. And I'll be in keynotes really often where I'll role play bringing someone up and I'll ask them to say no to a meeting and pretend I'm the inviter. And they say it very eloquently. And then I ask them if they would really say it that way. And they say, oh, no. Because it's It's an underexplored area of professional interchange, how hard this really is, especially for people who are not as senior. So opting out, we want to work toward and practice. You can get a nobody who can be your pal to practice the no before you give it. Figure out, does it sound entitled? Am I sounding like a shirker? Or does it sound too firm? Do I sound like a doormat? And you can practice getting the no right. And then you can also practice the tool called On Call. And I would have to say, of all of our meeting tools, this might be one of my favorites. It's so simple. You act like a doctor with a pager. You go on call for a meeting instead of attending. Now, everyone has to learn this as a team. But what we do is, let's say I know you're needed and I'm needed, but Jamie might be needed. I put you and me on the invite and I put Jamie in the notes on call. What does that mean? That means that she will sit at her desk. She will do activities that could be easily interrupted, like catch up on email or write. She won't be on the phone or a Zoom. And if we need her, we will ping her because she's on call like a doctor with a pager. Now, remember, a lot of times we would have invited Jamie to that meeting and she would have sat through 50 minutes of something she wasn't needed for just to wait for the 10 minutes where we might have needed her. And in on call, you completely evaporate that problem. She gets good work done for the majority of the meeting. And if and when we need her, we ping her in. So those are just a couple of random things that we use to help people create more margin. And I think that they'll be useful for any tool that chooses to use them together.
Mm-hmm. I know you also do a lot of work. I know we've talked about different ways that you work with leaders. And part of it too is the busyness of that can get into leadership. What is hands-off leadership?
Just letting them do it. Just letting them do it. It's so hard because we care and we're the smartest and we deal with our leadership anxiety through micromanaging sometimes and we have control issues and we have all these things that kind of stew together, me included, that makes us just want to keep putting our hands on stuff. But when you take your hands off, it will be the first time that you know what your team is capable of. And you will also be helping them grow in a way that is so fortifying to their future. The analogy I often talk about, I just saw this in another book too. I think it was Think Like a Monk. He references the biosphere, which was this create. Do you know what the biosphere was?
Oh, was that like in Arizona or something like that?
Yeah, like
eight people living in a
yes.
bubble.
Yeah, the crazy glass structure, and they replicated the biosphere of the Earth with all these different biomes, and scientists went in and were sealed in there for 2 years, and they had babies, and it was a whole crazy story. But the thing about the biosphere that is relevant for our conversation is the trees in the biosphere. They planted trees, they had absolutely perfect nutrition, absolutely perfect water and perfect temperature, and they grew up straight, and then they fell over dead. And no one could figure out why this was until they realized that wind is a necessary process in the pursuit of trees becoming strong. The wind pushes against the tree, the cells get stronger in response. The wind pushes, the cells get stronger a million times a day over and over and over. And because there was no wind in the biosphere, the trees had no strength. And this is the analogy that I like to talk about with delegating and your team and folks that are coming up, is you have to expose them to the challenges. You have to expose them to something a little harder than they're used to. Otherwise, you'll never get your next set of people that you can really depend on. We call it second tier delegation, not the first tier that you already know and love and you give them your firstborn and go to, you know, Panama, but the next people that you kind of sort of almost trust, but not really. We need to grow them to support you. And the only way to do that is hands off.
Yeah. And that's really fascinating because that is such a difficult thing as a leader. I know you don't have to share them here. I know you've got some really funny stories about that with you and family and some others that you have that. So I'm curious to know with you though, so you don't have to share those stories, but where did this idea come from for you? Like, are you just naturally, because there are two types of speakers and authors I work with. Some that are like, I was absolutely horrible with this, so I developed this system so I could do it. Now I teach others, so I'm not quite as horrible. And then there's other ones like, this was just what I was made to do in the first place. So where did the idea of all this, of, you know, whether it's from white space or moment to think, where did that come from for you? Because I know you've got a really interesting background. Like, all over.
Type number one, the I suck at this and therefore I've made it my career type. That's the type one in your scenario. I am the busiest, fast moving, hyper lady. If I didn't have a copy of my own book in my purse, I would probably forget to take a minute to think, because I really do believe that I can't wait to meet the people that you're describing that are type number two, because usually in my experience of 25 years, most authors and experts figured out the problem they couldn't solve for themselves and started solving it and became curious and then ended up solving it for thousands of people. And that is absolutely my path. I have a lot of trouble, whether it be business or kids or husband, taking a step back. Mm-hmm. We don't have time for those long stories, but I'll tell you a very short one. I came home one day in my own house and there was a gallon of milk in the fridge. I had a post-it note on it that said, I know this is the wrong milk. And it was lactose-free milk in a house where no one is lactose intolerant. But the post-it note was already there. It was a preemptive nag post-it note of, before you jump in, I know this is the wrong milk. And that's very indicative of who I can be when I'm not being my best. I can put my fingers on everything and correct everything. And so I really do think that we hang out in the areas that we need most correction in. And that's certainly been my case.
That's great. I love it. And that happens to me too. I preemptively say, I totally messed up on this, just so you know, I'm aware of it, and I'll go get the right milk, because we have like so many different types of milk in my house. It's not even funny. So anyway, well, Juliet, thank you so much for coming on and sharing so much wisdom here. And for those watching, listening, make sure to check out Juliet Funt, premierspeakers.com. Also, she has a LinkedIn newsletter, as she mentioned. Definitely check that out. And she's available, has so many things available, as well as books. And so, Juliet, thank you again so much for coming on and being part of the Beyond Speaking podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us for the Beyond Speaking podcast. To learn more about today's guest, visit premierspeakers.com. Make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen.